Welcome to another episode of Bulletproof. My name is Steve Stanulis. We have another amazing guest today. Before we even bring him on, I want to thank everybody for making us a top 10 podcast on both Apple and Spotify. We still have about 8 spots to go before we reach number one. But again, it's not because of people like myself or my voice, it's because of people like our next guest. Today's guest is someone who literally died and came back, literally died and came back. He was a deputy sheriff, Brandon Griffith, who was dead for over 15 minutes. And I'm very excited to talk about this, Brandon, because I got to talk to you about something that you probably didn't realize. Most people don't get a second chance, but Brandon did. And when doing it now, if he did it now or could do it all over again, could he say something from that experience that could help save somebody else's life? So, Brandon, thank you so much for joining us today. Brandon, you literally died, bro. What happened? How'd that even come about?
Yeah, man, I wish I could tell you I was doing something cool. I wish I could tell you that I was in a foot pursuit or fighting a tweaker or saving a kid or some shit. But, like 4 out of 5 cases, mine happen at home. My wife makes fun of me because I've been shot at. I've been in knife fights. I got trapped under a vehicle during a water rescue, and I died at home reading a book. Like, you don't get to pick how cool it is you go out, right? So I was sitting with her and reading my book. I put it down. I said, hey, I'm going to take the dog out. I take 2 steps towards my den door and just. If you ever had someone jump out and scare you, when your heart like skips that beat, you get that weird flutter feeling in your chest, that hit me immediately. And even though I collapsed in about a second and a half, I remember my entire incident, what I experienced in death and coming back, where most cardiac arrest survivors kind of get filled in, right? And from law enforcement, weird shit happens in critical stress incidents, right? Auditory disclusion, tunnel vision, time distortion, and that's exactly what I'm starting to experience. All of a sudden, I'm stopping dead in my tracks, just going, oof. All of a sudden, I got this weird flutter in my chest, and I'm trying to do how we're trained to do combat breathing. But it turns out when you're in ventricular fibrillation, there's no blood flow to your lungs, so they physically can't expand with oxygen. So I was literally just going, trying to force myself to breathe. My wife was on
Now,
the computer.
I'm sorry, your wife was with you at this time, or
She was
were you by
in the
yourself
room. She was in the
in
room
the
working on
room?
the computer while I was reading. So she turns around, sees my face as the darkest purple. We were both EMTs together before I got into law enforcement. So she immediately recognizes this as an emergency, pulls her phone out, calls 911, puts it on speaker, and drops it. I fall backwards into my bookshelf, breaking every tear on the way down. She goes to kind of brace me. I'm 6'4", she's 5'3", so I topple right over her, put my head through the wall. I land on my hands and my knees, and I'm looking out in my hallway. I'm starting to get tunnel vision, but it's nothing like I've experienced in the field where it's either hard to focus or you get hyper focused. My vision was
Right.
this like dark purplish black, and it's like caving in on me. Here I was, an EMT, a cop. I don't know how many life saves I got at this point, but there wasn't a damn thing I could do to save my own life. And I remember that feeling of helplessness and just being like, well, shit, this is it. I collapsed. I dropped dead right there. My wife rolls me on my back. She started to work on me. She said that I was still in lockjaw. My jugular veins are distended and my jaw's locked. She's trying to smack me out of it. She starts doing compressions. She worked on me for about the first 4 and a half minutes. And she even had the presence of mind to put my feet up on the couch, which is what we did for patients in shock, right? It forces the oxygenated blood in your legs to go down to your core. She did that while working on her high school sweetheart. I can't even get ER docs to do that shit. So she works on me. The first police officer arrives. She stops, goes and opens the door, holds the dog back. He comes in. He was not equipped with an AED, but he got to work. He started doing compressions. He worked on me until about the 9 and a half minute mark. Fire and EMS showed up after they got done playing Xbox. They dragged my body in the living room where they got more room to work. Cut off one of my favorite Nirvana shirts, drop in the OPA, IO drill me. They did a hell of a job, man. They shocked me multiple times, and eventually they did get me. They got my heart rate back at about 16 minutes and 48 seconds. According to
Now,
my
let's
wife.
stop right there first. Let's
Yeah.
stop. I have a couple questions with this. All right. So, first of all, how the fuck can I cut your Nirvana shirt? Why couldn't they get that over your head at least and not stay in the Nirvana shirt? That's question number one. But in all seriousness, Brandon, did you now again? Not to get because and there's a reason why I want to share this with you, which is very interesting and very ironic. But when you were technically dead for those 16 minutes, do you recall anything? Do you again, some people recall getting leaving their body and seeing everything going on, or did you see a light, or did you see it, were you did you feel like you were out of your body, or were you just like unconscious? How did you feel? And there's a again there's a second follow-up question, but because you hear so many stories, especially with somebody who's been gone as long as you. So let's stick with the first question first. How did you have any experience?
Yes, for sure.
And what
Yeah,
was
it's,
that?
it immediately from when I dropped dead, I remember saying, this is it. And when I collapsed, it was an immediate transcendence. Immediately, I'm out of my body. I'm just, there's no thought of fear. There's no pain. There's no anxiety. Like, it was the most calm, relaxed, surreal, like, blissful feeling ever. Right. And I remember just kind of being in this space. It's kind of a calming blackness at first. And it's weird because you talk to different survivors. I've been able to work with survivor groups and near-death experts and physicians from around the world. And in that first 7 minutes of death, there's different things that happen, right? After the 7 minutes of death, it's pretty much all uniform for most people I talk to. But the reason why we picked that 7 minute mark is because that's the longest ever recorded brainwave. So after that 7 minute mark, your brain cannot process memories. You cannot connect neurons. Your body can't break down chemicals like dimethyltryamine or adrenaline to give you hallucinations. So usually in those first 7 minutes, those are the stories you hear where they floated above the table while someone was doing surgery, or they were on the accident scene, their life flashed before their eyes. But the people that, like me, that had died longer, they went to that calm black spot, almost a dreamlike space. And the longer they were there, the more they saw. So all of a sudden, man, I'm sitting there and I'm being embraced, I'm being held. And just this overwhelming, like, righteous feeling of goodness, right? I'm being held and I'm having this conversation, but it's nothing like you and I are having right now. It's not words, it's not, I wouldn't call it ESP. It was more feelings and intuition, just instant understanding. And as I'm sitting there, the longer I'm there, the more shapes and silhouettes and things I'm starting to see. Now, my personal belief is that it takes a while for your soul to adjust to the other side, right? I'm a man of faith. I believe in God. And I don't know who was holding me. I don't know if that was my guardian angel. I don't know if that was Jesus. I don't know if that was a family member, but I was being held and having this conversation. And the longer I'm there, the more I'm starting to see, kind of like your night vision develops. When you go take a piss in the middle of the night, you can see everything crystal clear because your cone vision had developed. The longer I was there, the more I was seeing. And other survivors that I talked to, like, said the exact same thing. The longer they were there, others saw relatives, other had other experiences on the other side, but that all started in that calm blackness and that feeling. And they talk about that in Corinthians as well, where they start in the calm blackness until you're awoken. So, I mean, that's my personal theory there. As I'm having this conversation, I'm starting to see more and more. I'm getting some insights on my personal life. And then literally, like, someone flipped a light switch, just I'm back in my body. The pain is back. The fear is back. I mean, I could taste the blood in my mouth. I could feel where they drilled through my leg. The compressions on my chest felt like someone had beat me up with a baseball bat. You ever fall asleep on your hands and legs get that painful pins and needles? That was
Yeah, of course.
everywhere. That was like on steroids, man. And then my head, with every single heartbeat, I was getting this white flash and that, like, huge migraine pain. Like someone was just taking a sledgehammer to the top of my head. Now, my wife and the crew said that I kind of sat up and started pushing guys off me. I don't remember that part. I remember the pain. I remember, like, those white flashes. And my wife said she grabbed me by the face and told me not to leave her. I told her I wouldn't before I collapsed back again. I didn't go back into cardiac arrest. I just didn't have the strength to sit up. And I could feel the sway of the gurney. I could hear the firefighters walking on the rocks in my front yard. But from that moment, I remember my whole dying. I remember death. I remember coming back, but it's the next 5 days as my brain was recovering from hypoxic damage and the cardiac arrest that I don't remember. I've got pictures and glimpses. I mean, they said I was cracking jokes, calling the guys hose draggers in the back of the ambulance. They said, I'm waking up in the ICU and I got my SWAT team around me. I'm sobbing with my wife for some reason. Like, just pictures is all I get from the next 5 days where they start doing all the tests and trying to figure out why I died.
That's crazy. And because like I said, and I'm actually, again, I'm Catholic. I believe in everything too. And I believe, obviously in, paranormal, which obviously paranormal, if there's spirits, right, there's, you're going somewhere, right? I believe in, again, exorcisms, right? So if there's exorcism and demons, obviously there's got to be something out. If you could go in with a, and again, not that's not this ain't that type of podcast, but if you could get a priest to, and you could exorcise someone who was actually, whether they're truly, a demonic possession, and you could go with holy water, right, and read verses from the Bible and get them out. Then obviously that's got to mean, or not, if there wasn't a somewhere up above, they would just laugh. It would just laugh at you. It'd be like, all right, So obviously there's both, right? So, A, we're all energy, right? And again, I don't, this is what this is about, but we are all energy, and obviously, it's not only amazing to hear, but it's all actually also comforting, right? That we're not just a fucking unit, and once we shut our eyes, that's it, right? We shut down like the Terminator, right? So, and it always interested me, and this is where I'm going with this, and it's ironic, it may be kismet that you and I actually met and we're speaking. So I scroll, sometimes as everybody does, we scroll on YouTube, right? And I'm just scrolling through videos, and something caught my eye that I would never watch. And I just, for whatever reason, I watched it, right? And it was called Lazarus Syndrome, right? And I don't know if you're familiar with Lazarus Syndrome, but Lazarus Syndrome is obviously you die, whatever, you're being worked on, whatever, you die, you're pronounced, and after 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes, you come back. And obviously there's some scientific behind it, why, and obviously Lazarus syndrome is obviously Lazarus, who Lazarus was, and Jesus rose from the dead. But I'm actually working on a new film and a project in going into pre-production called Lazarus Syndrome, based on watching that particular video that I never even knew existed or even knew what Lazarus syndrome was. I found it so interesting. And it's just wild that we're just going into pre-production, right? And now I'm interviewing you. And again, you didn't just kind of, get pronounced in 3 minutes and come back. You were gone for a significant amount of time. I'm not going to say that was
Absolutely.
almost close to Lazarus syndrome. And for people who don't know what it is, that you die, again, I mentioned you die for a big period of time, you're pronounced, and all of a sudden you come back. Whether that's some spiritual thing to it or some scientific reason, it's just ironic that you and I are talking, Brandon, and this is a story you're sharing. And I always watch and find it so interesting watching people's stories when they come back, and even doctors in the ER, what they experience when someone passes and they could actually see something coming out of their body, what have you. Again, it's funny because we're talking as cop to cop, but this is just something that I just find super fascinating, and it's amazing to me. So you go to the hospital. I mean, what was did you have any issues, or was it something that just happened right away? Or I mean, did you have any health issues prior, or just is something that came on, or? Or how'd this even come about that you had such a heavy heart attack?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. So one, it wasn't a heart attack. So a lot of people think heart disease is a blanket term, right? So it covers everything from heart attacks to cardiac arrest to strokes to STEMIs, all kinds of different things, right? But a heart attack is like a plumbing issue. Those are the old man that's breathing heavy, sweating, has chest pain. That's a plumbing issue where there's a blockage in the heart, right? Cardiac arrest is electrical. Imagine you plug in the Christmas tree, shit shorts out, right? Basically, the electrical malfunction caused my heart to go into this quivering motion where there was no blood flow to my body, and I dropped dead, right? So they start running all these tests on me, right? I'm 26 years old. I'm in phenomenal shape. I just made my SWAT team a couple weeks before that. I passed all my medical examinations. I was actually in a doctor's office and I got a full clean bill of health 2 hours before I died. Like, you just can't make it up, right? So they go
Yeah.
in, they start running all these tests. There's nothing wrong with my heart. There's no congenital defects. There's no electrolyte imbalances. I wasn't an energy drinker. I wasn't smoking crack. There was no actual cause to it. And from the time you're in the womb to the day you die, your heart sends these electrical impulses. And all it takes is one misfire for you to drop dead like I did. I'm convinced I had what's called the RNT phenomenon, where it just had a, it's called a preventricular contraction at the exact wrong time. And it sent me into ventricular fibrillation. But you know, it's just electrical sensors, right? One misfire and you drop dead. Now, it's been over 12 years since my cardiac arrest. I haven't had any secondary events. There's no defects, there's no myopathies, there's no anything. But all of a sudden they're like, well, we don't know if this is going to happen again, so we're going to put this defibrillator inside your chest. So all of a sudden I'm now ineligible to be a law enforcement officer in my state. At the time, they weren't allowing cops to go back to full active duty. So they're like, well, shit, he's damaged good. So I immediately lost my spot on my SWAT team. And now I'm facing forced medical retirement at 26. So I said, well, fuck this. I decided to fight against it. And I went against the state. I went against risk management. I went against our post. Luckily, my assistant chief at the time and our state medical director had my back. I was successful and I went back to full active duty in the field. I was one of the only cops in the time to have a defibrillator implanted in my chest and be able to go back to full active duty. So that's when I got back to the field and I realized how underutilized cops are. I mean, we're first on scene before fire and EMS 90% of the time by 5 to 20 minutes. And most of the time, our medical training is a joke. You know, some firefighter, some guy comes in and gives you a CPR card. You put in tourniquets on yourself or a pool noodle and they say, hey, you're certified, kid. But then that mom hands you the blue baby, and all of a sudden your confidence goes out the window, you know. So we really wanted to change that, and I wanted to use my second chance and earn what I was given by helping prepare, train, and equip cops, which is why we started the nonprofit, and we do reality-based training and donate medical equipment.
And we're getting into that in a little bit as well. I definitely want to get into that, but yes, I agree with you because I'm going to say New York because that's where I came from, right? And I was in the NYPD, but everything is about covering your ass, right? So, like you said, we get like an hour's worth of training, 2 hours worth of training, right? You get those obviously those dummies or whatever, the mannequins that you blow and you do it once or twice. And they're like, all right, great job, P.O. Stanulis, good job. All at that time, it's cadet, whatever I got called back then, whatever you were when we were probationary. But if I had to save somebody today, I don't, I would pretty much say it would be all instinctual. I'm not fucking, I mean, I have the card from when I was, I wouldn't call myself a professional, somebody that could, I would not jump forward if there was a room of 10 people, somebody else knew what they were doing. Because again, I had like an hour or two of training, and it's like that with anything. We used to shoot once a year in the NYPD, and that would qualify us. But again, are we really, what I mean? Are we really that good? Or are we really that qualified? So yes, and that was, that's called the city covering their ass and say, well, up, he was trained. You know what I mean? So, and it's on you. So unless you're not one of these guys that are really into being a cop and going to the range, you're really, trying to better yourself. Absolutely, I agree, and that's why I'm excited to talk to you about what you're doing now. The other main question I had, and I'm going to go back to Lazarus syndrome. So when he comes back in the movie, everything's different. Right, everything for him now is not what it was. And again, this is Jacob's Ladder meets the Sixth Sense. So obviously, it's a very psychological thriller. But he's not, everything's off with his life, with his partner, with everything. Did you feel anything off or change, or what was the biggest change you noticed, if any, after that whole incident happened?
There's a lot to unpack there, but I mean, literally, my whole life changed in a heartbeat, man. Like
No
you're
pun
focused,
intended.
you're singularly focused on what you're doing beforehand. You're part of the SWAT team, and you're 20. I was a 26-year-old kid. Like I thought, being a cop was my identity. And we know that's bullshit. That's what we do, but it's not who we are, right?
Right.
So Coming back, I definitely felt myself much more in tune to my spirituality, the Holy Spirit, whatever you want to call it. I was definitely much more in tune to my guiding light. I could definitely, I would be pointed into ways, into different directions, what I was doing. And what's weird is that at different pivotal points in my life, I remember more of the conversation I had on the other side as different things happen over the last 12 years. And it fills you with a sense of righteousness, and it can fill you with a sense of dread when you're going down the wrong way. So, I mean, whether you call it the Holy Spirit or whatever you want to call it, I've definitely been pointed into doing what I'm supposed to be doing and into my new style of service and running the nonprofit and whatnot. So, I mean, I thought that I wanted to go back, and I did. I went back to full active duty and I earned my stripes again and I got back out with my guys. But the more I started working in the cardiac space and helping train officers and prepare them, man, the more that guiding light was pushing me out of full-time law enforcement. And I started realizing, I'm like, man, I just taught this agency over here. I helped them get AEDs and they just got 17 saves in their first year. These guys are feeling more confident in themselves. I'm like, I can do much more helping these guys save as many lives as possible than I can do individually on the streets. So, I mean, th there's definitely points in my life where I'm more in tune to the other side and it's telling me do this or not to do that. And other survivors that I've talked to have that same kind of guiding light. I don't know. If you look at your brain, it's kind of like an antenna that's connected to the other side with your soul. Maybe it's more in tune after you go through a near-death experience. I don't really know how to explain it, but there was definitely ups, there was definitely downs. There was an emotional roller coaster that happened after that when your identity's challenged. And you know, I had survivor's guilt too, man. Like I buried five friends in the line of duty, and here I was given a second chance. These guys didn't get to go raise their kids. I was able to have two beautiful kids after my cardiac arrest that never would have been born. I don't take that shit for granted, you know what I mean?
No doubt, man. No doubt. So, in a weird way, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, you get chicken shit. Sometimes you turn it into chicken soup, right? So, would you say, in some weird way, going through that experience changed your life for the better?
Oh, 100%.
In some weird way?
There's no question, man. Like I have gotten more out of what I'm doing now than I could ever get back, man. I absolutely look at my cardiac arrest as a blessing, not as a, you know, people want to talk to you like you're a fucking victim, you know. I'm so sorry that happened to you. And I'm like, you know what? I feel bad for my wife. She's the one that had to live through the trauma. I was dead on the floor. She had to watch me not breathing. She had to do compressions and feel my chest pop underneath her hands. Like
But
she was afraid to leave me alone for the first 6 months, man. If I was snoring or some shit, she hit me thinking I was dying again. So like she had my team leader babysitting me at points when she was at work. Like I felt bad for her, but like it wasn't a traumatic incident for me. I didn't have this weird sense, right? Like I looked at it as a huge blessing. I was given a second chance that most people don't. Like fucking earn it. I wanted to get back out there and do something with my second chance and give God a reason to keep me around, man. So it was definitely a blessing. It put me on this path. Now I get to travel around the country, training cops how to save lives, implementing programs. I get to take my family with me to travel here and there. You know, I mean, I've gotten so much more out of the work that we're doing, from new friendships to helping these guys out to helping these ladies out there. It's connected me on a whole different level, and it's definitely very rewarding.
Well, last question I have on this. What if this never happened, right? You know, everything just went as planned, and you know, 26, you got, you're ready to go, get promoted. What would be the biggest change? And I think I already know the answer, but what would your life be like today, Brandon, if that never happened? What would be the biggest difference from Brandon today to Brandon that just, got promoted, ready to go into a new unit, and everything was never, nothing ever happened. Everything was always hunky dory. What would Brandon look like today as opposed?
I don't think I would have ever unlocked my true potential. I think I would have continued. I would have been a SWAT operator. I probably would have been a career street cop. I mean, I'm still a sworn deputy. I still serve Pinal County Sheriff's Office as a reservist, but I would have stayed in that position and tried to be just stay as a firearms instructor, stay as a DT instructor, stay in SWAT as long as I possibly could. But this opportunity opened up so many doors for me, man. I got to work with resuscitation titans. I got to speak at universities. I got to work with scientific advisory councils. I got to surround myself with, true people that are the pinnacle of excellence in their careers. And I got it just opened so many different doors for me, from friends to podcasts to me becoming a columnist to writing things to testifying on the Senate floor to legislation. Like, it's just opened up so many opportunities. I would have never known any part of it because I never went to business school. I never wanted to become a CEO and run a nonprofit. I don't know shit about this. I had to learn from the ground up how to do this stuff. I had to become a subject matter expert. I had to dive into, I was a street cop learning medical shit. So, I mean, I don't think I ever would have unlocked the potential. I wouldn't have been able to make, there's no way in hell I would have been able to make the impacts that I've been able to, man. I can't tell you how great it feels when I get those phone calls. Hey, man, we just saved a 1-year-old. I just put the AED. The guy, they came right back. I shocked them twice. Awesome. I just put a tourniquet. I use my Narcan. Hey, we just saved a fellow officer's life. When I speak and these officers are saying, hey, man, I'm having some of these PVCs you were talking about too. They go get checked out. Turns out they were this close from having a widowmaker. They were this close from having a cardiac arrest. And they go, man, I'm alive today because I listened to you speak at this conference. Like, I would have never been able to unlock any of that, which is why I said, man, like, I'm almost ashamed of it because I've gotten more out of it than I'm ever going to be able to give back.
That's amazing. Listen, it's amazing. And again, I believe everything happens for a reason. And obviously that was meant to be, because obviously there was more for you to give. And obviously you took the ball and you ran. Because like I said, I can't speak for everybody, but I do know people that have had second chances. And instead of saying, wow, now, I got a wake up call. Now I'm gonna go, I'm gonna do this, and they fell right back into what I mean, put them where they were in the first place, or whatever tragedy that was, that they, experienced. But, and I've seen people like yourself that said, you know what, I'm here for a reason now. I mean, it's bigger than me. I was pretty here. I was put here by God, a higher power, whatever. My time wasn't ready, and now I'm gonna do everything I possibly can. So, I mean, and that's amazing. So, before we get into our 10-second speed round questions, please share with everybody what you're doing now, how they find you, how they could be involved, and just give it a little, backstory on what it actually is.
Yeah, so now I run Griffith Blue Heart nonprofit. We prepare, train, and equip cops around the country for medical emergencies. So we do all the boring shit that makes it work, like legislative compliance, policy writing, dispatch protocols, sustainability planning. But we do stuff that really gets cops hooked into it. We do reality-based training because we can't stand those trainings where it's like, all right, here's your PowerPoint, here's your clicker mannequin, do a couple compressions, you're certified, right? We can't stand that shit. Cops thrive in reality-based, doing field scenarios, active shooter drills, and hostage rescue and barricade shit, sims force on force. So we said, you know what, all of our guys come from the SWAT background, why don't we take that methodology of training and apply it to frontline medical? Your SWAT medics are awesome. I mean, they're doing live tissue labs, they're stabbing goats and doing blood transfusions in the field and stuff, going through 18 Delta, but it's your frontline guys that get jack and shit. So we wanted to create a program for them that uses proficiency based, where they're using mannequins with sensors that measure depth, recoil, brain perfusion. We're having them put pads on live role players. We're having them use Narcan, where they're actually wearing bleeding simulators that spurt blood. They're tourniqueting over that. They're putting chest seals over people. Like, we want to keep this grounded into what they're doing, where they're actually having to make arrests. They're still doing searches. They still have legal standards and they have to follow the Fourth Amendment. I mean, we're making sure that the reality-based training is applicable to what they're doing, and all the scenarios are based on actual calls our guys have been through. So we do that. We do an advanced course, and we also do a train the trainer course. So we've been able to make armies of trainers around the country who are able to further this without us, so it can be sustainable and grow. But we've helped them to navigate fundings. I mean, we just last year we put, $1.6 million just in one area of AEDs in cops' hands. And they're being used like you wouldn't believe, man. They're first on scene 90% of the time. So throwing two stickers on and pressing a button is simple. These guys and girls are just getting life saves like they're candy now, right? So that's pretty much what we're doing now. It's griffithblueheart.com. We are a 501c3. We work with a lot of manufacturers and people out there to sponsor law enforcement training. So we work with different agencies that host our stuff. We're going to be across the nation most of this year. We're already booked pretty much through September. So, I mean, we're still booking up our calendar for the rest of the year, but yeah, it's very rewarding, man, being able to do this. We also do the health and wellness aspects. We talk about why law enforcement's at a higher risk for heart disease in the general public, why our average lifespan is 57 years old. We talk about how to mitigate those risks. We point them in the right direction. And we've also helped a lot of police officers navigate their own health battles and be able to return to full active duty. We've got 12 different cops and firefighters that would have been sidelined, but we used my incident and case law and helped them navigate the program. And now they're back to full active duty with defibrillators in their chests.
It's awesome. And again, another thing I like that you said is you do it real life scenario, because you know what? A lot of the, and we all have them in everywhere, you know, everywhere you go, every state, every city, every county, you always have the guys that, you know, all the guys that are around forever, right? That, you know, that you have a lot of time on the job, the older guys. And, you know, and I can see, I have guys I can think of in my head that if you just put a mannequin there and he's got to learn and compress and do all that stuff, it's going to be more of a goof type of deal and more of a you know, a fun and like, oh my God.
Grab
And I can
ass.
see guys, you know, making comments about what the mannequin, especially if it's female, whatever, just goofing around. I love the fact that it's scenarios. It's you know, because believe it or not, we used to do something, you know, where we would go, and it was called the Fun House, and we would give like 10 scenarios. You know, two guys would go each, and there'd be like 10 cops watching. And when you would, whatever job you had per se, once you get into it, right, your adrenaline starts going and stuff. It simulates the real life stuff, and then again, you know what your peers are watching. Right, you know, you're being judged, and you know, whatever the scenario is, you kind of get into it. So I love the fact that that's what you guys are doing, because it's taken a lot more serious, A, and you learn, and then even if you fuck up, you know, everybody could kind of critique in a good way, you know, what you could have done better, what you did, why'd you do it that way, and it just makes it for a much more educational, interesting day and procedure. So I love that. That's amazing. You know what I mean?
We
Because
love seeing them get those eureka moments, man, when these guys are out there, because you've been through it, man. You're doing building clearing or whatnot, and then all of a sudden the blank rounds start going off. Fucking hands, they start just really getting into it, and you're like, man, you know you're holding a rubber gun, bro. Like, but it's part of that stress inoculation. It recodes the brain and it helps them overcome these situations. And a lot of these guys realize how deficient they are in their life-saving skills when they do this with mannequins that have sensors, or they're putting a tourniquet over an actual tube that's bleeding. If they don't put it on tight enough, it doesn't stop the bleed. Getting that immediate feedback and getting coached through it, these guys are like, man, I had no idea. I thought I was ready to do this stuff, but I got some things I need to polish. And watching them work through that, where someone's life is not actually on the line, is very rewarding.
Absolutely. So I'm going to give you 10 questions without thinking. Just give me the first thing that comes to mind.
Let's
Okay.
do it.
All right. What's the one mistake people make in an emergency?
Hesitancy and failing to recognize the situation. We see people do that all the time, where how many cops are going on drug overdoses and they're all fucking using their Narcan. They got six, seven doses of Narcan, but no one's recognizing the patient stopped breathing 4 minutes ago. They're not going, oh, wait a minute, there's no rise and fall of the chest. We should have started compressions 4 minutes ago. It's not a shooting. You're not going to get days off because you guys all use your Narcan. Like, being able to immediately recognize when something's going on, hypovolemic shock or things like that. People that are just afraid to act, especially bystanders. How many times are you guys getting on scene and people are filming them, but no one's doing anything to help? We're not coded to respond to people outside of our tribe. So a lot of people with the bystander syndrome, it's very real where they go, somebody else will do it. Like you talked about earlier in the podcast, you're like, hey, if there's 10 of us around, I don't know if I'd be the first one to jump on it. But that reluctancy where people are failing to act is killing people. By doing nothing, by waiting for the professionals, their brain is dying. If you sit there and do shit, you are actively killing them. So having the urgency to actually step up and recognize these emergencies is vital.
Okay, very good. Most underrated life-saving skill.
High performance compressions and AED. You know, these people out there nowadays, everyone's heard the saying CPR saves lives, right? Well, most people suck at it, and they don't actually use proficiency metrics. They don't actually measure depth, recoil. They don't actually make sure if there's good brain perfusion. They use these clicker mannequins. Well, guess what? Real people don't click like that. They don't tell you if you're doing a good job in the real world. People don't realize that CPR does not save lives. CPR delays death. You are buying time for them to get the shock. You can do compressions all day long. The compressions are not going to actually save them. Those breaths you're giving is not going to bring them out of it. It's the defibrillator that delivers that counter electricity that gets the heart out of that deadly arrhythmia. The faster you put the defibrillator on and deliver that therapeutic shock, the more likely they are to survive. That's what's most underrated. Get the AED on as soon as possible. If you call 911, go grab that AED and start compressions and get them on as quick as possible if you want to save their life. Because we do a lot of training for firearms, but there was about 1,200 fatal shootings last year total for all of law enforcement around the country. 931,000 Americans died from heart disease last year. It's the number one cause of death, and globally, we lost 17 million.
Okay. All right. Very good. Something everyone should have in their house.
I can't recommend enough having an AED. I mean, we all buy guns, we all buy security systems and dogs and all kinds of cool shit, but the number one cause of death is heart disease, and 4 out of 5 cases happen inside the home. Everyone talks about public access defibrillation, but that's only 20% of cases. Yes, we need AEDs in our schools, we need them in our airports and our sports arenas, but inside your home, people aren't thinking that their perfectly healthy 17-year-old daughter, there's, you know, their young athletic son is going to be the ones that drop, and young athletic males are at the highest risk. So having that AED and being able to respond to your family is vital, particularly if you're in law enforcement, fire services, military. We are at a 70 times higher risk for heart disease than the general public. It's cool that we know how to save lives, but do our spouses and our kids, because we're the ones that are actually going to be dropping in that living room.
Okay. Biggest myth about cardiac arrest.
Everyone thinks that just by doing compressions that they're going to get back out of it. Again, they need the defibrillation. They need to get that AED on them. But what a lot of people don't know is that there's a significant amount of cases that you're not going to save. Even if you watch them drop, you put the AED on the chest and you did picture perfect compressions, there are arrhythmias that are just not shockable. And there's something that's not talked about, particularly in law enforcement. You can do everything right and they can still die. It's outside of your circle of control. They may have had a, you know, pulseless electrical activity or asystole, something that's not shockable, but you can still hold your head up high knowing you did everything you possibly could to save them.
What does being bulletproof mean to you?
Being bulletproof and comfortable in yourself, your skills, and your capabilities, and what you can and cannot deliver for those around you. Like none of us are immortal, or none of us are getting out of this world alive. But making yourself the hardest target, making yourself completely capable in all aspects of your life, from being spiritually sound, healthy, the mental and the physicality of your life, and being prepared for those around you. That's what makes you truly bulletproof, is when you're ready, you anticipate those situations, you prepare for them, you look at yourself, and you take time to take care of yourself and your loved ones.
And the last one, what's something people ignore that could kill them?
Oh, there's so many things here. We, particularly in law enforcement, suck at recognizing heart disease, right? Because we're used to operating in high stress environments. We're used to having adrenaline dumps. We're used to having heart flutters. We're used to having back, neck, and chest pain. We're used to having tinglies just because we're on the job and we're constantly going from dopamine laughing with our brothers and sisters to adrenaline to cortisol stress. We don't recognize these issues. And these guys that are just having these clusters of PVCs in their chest to the point where it's getting them dizzy, or they're going, oh, well, that was weird. They ignore that. And those are huge signs that you're going to have an electrical malfunction. You're going to drop dead. So ignoring the PVC clusters, if you're bearing down, if you're getting dizzy when you shouldn't be, if you're getting out of breath earlier, if you're having those weird flutters and feelings in your chest, don't ignore that. Go get a full cardiac screening. And I'm not talking about just regular physical, turn your head and cough. I mean, get lipid panels, get calcium coronary scores, get ECGs and ultrasounds, and just go talk to a real cardiologist. And a lot of people think that just because they went to a standard cardiologist that they're fine, but there's plumbing and there's electrical. Make sure you're getting checked with an electrophysiologist. If you've been, all of your plumbing's been cleared by a cardiologist and you're still symptomatic, say, I want to go talk to an electrophysiologist and go see the expert, because most of the time they're going to put you on a Holter monitor, they're going to do a targeted ECG, and that's where they find these myopathies. That's where they, they're not myopathies, they find these electrical malfunctions like Wolff Parkinson's White and Brugada and long QT syndrome. So don't ignore those things and make sure that you're taking care of yourself.
There you go. There you go. Well, I gotta say, you don't really ever expect to sit across from someone who's actually been gone, and now I can say I have, and they came back bigger, better, stronger, and more motivated than they ever been in their life. And I want to say kudos to you. And again, I could talk to you for hours just on the whole spiritual, there's so many questions I wanted to get into with that, but I just didn't want to turn it just into that type of podcast, which I would have minded doing myself, because I could have done that for about 3 hours, and I find it so fascinating. So again, before we go, Brandon, what if somebody wanted to reach out to you personally? Do you have any social media, or is it just the, your 501c, or how do we get in touch with you?
Yeah, so I'm on LinkedIn under Brandon Griffith. I'm also, the nonprofit's got Griffith Blue Heart on Instagram. We've got our website, griffithblueheart.com. I mean, there's plenty of ways to get a hold of us if you guys are interested in working with us in a nonprofit capacity or speaking or health. If you just have questions about your own heart issues, hit us up. I'm more than happy to help you and share our experiences.
It's amazing. Well, Brandon, thank you so much today for giving us the time. Again, you're probably the first person ever that's come on Bulletproof that, came on and has a certain profession. And we probably talked about 2 seconds about that said profession and focus on everything else that has happened. But like I said, in this particular point, it was definitely worth it. It was educational, and I'm sure our listeners are going to appreciate and want to reach out at some point. Before I let you go, again, I want to thank all our listeners. I want to thank our sponsors at Believe. I want to thank you again for making our podcast the top 10 podcast. Again, it's not because of the podcast of myself, it's because amazing stories like Brandon Griffith. And Brandon, thank you so much for coming on. And as everybody who's listening, as always, stay bulletproof.